This is an interview for the Mill Workers Oral History Project. The date is March 30, 2006, and today I'm at the Bates Mill with Gerard Bergeron, and this is Andrea Lemgia. Could you start just by telling me your full name?
Gerard D. Bergeron.
And where were you born?
I was born here in Lewiston.
And what's your birth date?
April 1st.
1926. So you were an April Fool's baby.
Right. Yeah.
And your parents, what were their names?
My father's name was Alexander Bergeron. My mother was as a LaPointe. She's from Canada. They both come from Canada.
So but they were born in Canada?
They were born in Canada. And the family was all born in Lewiston. My mother came to Lewiston with my father, and they settled over here.
And how many brothers and sisters did you have?
I have one brother, which lives in Oakland, California. Mm-hmm. And I have one sister here in Lewiston. And the others passed away. Yeah.
So how many children were there?
There was five of us.
Yeah. And why did your parents come to Maine from Canada? Did they talk
about
it?
They came from St. Honore.
And why? For work?
Yeah, they had to work. It was about just the only thing they had around here was the mills at the time. Mm-hmm. When they came over. They came to work. They worked in the mills, yeah.
What did they do in Canada? Don't know.
They were both born on a farm. Oh, I can tell you that much. They were brought up on a farm, yeah.
Now, what part of Lewiston did you live?
I lived on Donald Street. That's at Thorn's Corner. It's about 2 or 3 miles from town here. Mm-hmm. And I went to Holy Family School, grammar school. And high school, I never finished high school. I quit while I was working on a second shift at Bates. I quit.
And
it was too much to work and go, so I quit. It's too bad. Today, I'm sorry that I didn't keep going, but that's the way it went. And during the process of my time at Bates, I've tried very hard to become a loom fixer. I was interested in becoming, I'd done just about every job in the weave room, worked my way up. And I was interested in becoming a loom fixer. I like mechanical work, so. But there was the overseer of the department at the time was a Mr. Malloy, Bill Malloy. And for some reason or other, he never really liked me, you know. And I have had a very hard time to get on to learn how to fix looms. And I could have done something about it because at the time I could have gone on it on the GI Bill. Mm-hmm. But I didn't. I just said to myself, I'm going to find a way to get, if I don't become a fixer, I'm going to find a way to get ahead of them. You know? So that's around in the 1960s, late 50s or early 60s, quite a while back. I picked up in a magazine that a correspondence school, I think it was from Scranton, Pennsylvania, ICS, International Correspondence School. So I started reading what they had for courses, and I noticed they had a loom fixer supervisor course on there. And it was a 3.5-year course. It was quite a... So I told my wife, I'm going to take that course. But I never told the company a word. I just took the course. And I was able to go through it in less than 2 years. And it took a while after I got my diploma. Finally, they reached me. The school reached me asking me if they mind if I let the Bates Manufacturing Company know that I've taken a course with them. So I said, well, okay with me, I guess, because I never said nothing to nobody. So they did call the company. So the first thing I knew, I was called in the personnel office about the course. Why didn't you tell us? I said, well, I don't know, it's just in material. I didn't, just never gave it a thought. She said, if you'd have told us, we'd have paid for your course. Mm-hmm. But they did offer to pay half. So I appreciated it. And let's see.
So did that help you?
Oh, very much so.
In what way?
Well, I that's how I became a supervisor. I worked about 24 years as a small, as earlier, like a fill-in, they used to call them fill-in boys and bobbin boys and card boys, and but they changed the rules. You have to call them a person, you know, so there won't be no discrimination. You have to be a fill-in person, a bobbin boy, a bobbin person, and you know, whatever. Like the room girls, they used to call them room girls, but you couldn't call them room girls anymore. They were repair people, they were repair girls. You know, to repair smashers and break out, stuff like that. Oh, that was the, yeah. So they finally got it, so I came, they spoke to me, they told me that. They paid for half the course. It took a little while longer after that. I was approached to be, if I would, they would like to have me be a supervisor. They told me, we like the way you work and the way you produce. You always seem to try to produce more all the time, which that was my way. Weaving was piecework, so, and I weaved for 24 years, almost. The other job, I didn't stay too long on. I learned how to weave right away. And there was one particular fixer who helped me, a weaver that helped me how to weave. His name was Roland Pruno, and he helped me a lot, gave me a lot of tips, an old weaver. And I learned a lot from him. And it didn't take long. I was able to have my own set of looms. And you know how it is in the old days, well, still the same now. You have to, you know, build your seniority. You want to make sure you do good. You don't want to quit. You know, you want to keep your seniority built up. In 1944, I went into the service. In 44. And I was in the service 2.5 years. I was in the Air Force, and I enjoyed my service time very much. I never was called to active duty. Mm-hmm. I was one of the lucky ones that the atom bomb saved me from going on active duty at the time. Mm-hmm. Didn't only save me, it saved thousands of people and thousands of service people. It's too bad today you talk about those things to the younger generation. They can't seem to understand it very good. I don't know if they don't teach it more in the schools. Some of them think we should have never dropped the atom bomb there, and they're wrong. If Japan would have had the atom bomb, they wouldn't have hesitated to drop it on us. They're the ones that put the knife into our backs when they invaded, attacked Pearl Harbor. So we had a pretty good excuse to stop the war when we had a chance. We would have stopped it earlier, but I guess that it wasn't quite ready. But finally we got it ready in time to let them have it, and that's what stopped the war right there. So I was lucky in that respect. Not only myself, but a lot of others. After I got back home from the service, oh, I have to take it back. I have to go back a little bit now. Before I went into the service, that's how I left. That's why I left school. Before I left for the service, my mother took sick. And to help out, my sister dropped out of school. She was also, she's passed away now. She worked at base in the office for a while over here. She dropped out to take care of my mother, and I dropped out to go to work to help out, and I never went back.
Mm-hmm. So you were about 16 then?
I was 16 when I started to work, but it was a little before when my mother got sick, and we both stayed home, my sister and I, my older sister, and to help out the family. And things were going so good for me, making a little money, so it would have been better if I'd have gone back to school, but when you're young, you know, I'm making money, I decided that I'd stick with it. So I never went back to school. Then later on, that's when they sent us at CMVTI to take these management courses. It was very helpful. And didn't cost us nothing. I used to be, at the time they sent me to school, I was on a second shift. I was leaving to go to school on the job. I was leaving to go to school, and then after school, I'd come back to finish my shift. It was very nice. I don't have a thing against Bates Fabrics. It used to be Bates Manufacturing when I first started, then they changed it to Bates Fabrics. You know, they changed. Just like supervisors. Years ago, they used to call them secondhand. As it went along, then they called, when we started as a supervisor, that's when they started to call us supervisors. But when they gave us a raise, they had to change the title a little bit. So they couldn't put us as a overseer, but they called us assistant overseer instead of supervisor. But at the end, when they were starting to let a lot of supervisors go here, when the just before the Chinese people took over the company, they're the ones that really ruined the place. The Chinamen.
The Tang brothers.
Yes, and they own some mills down south also, you know, but they really ruined this place. They were nice to the people. You know, they had their gathering in the summertime for us, you know, but they're the ones that really, they bought this place for peanuts when they bought it. They bought, I think it was $8 million, if I remember right. You can't really remember, but they bought it for peanuts anyways at the time. But they were tearing part of number 5 down, which I knew was not right. They finally did caught up with them. They were even tearing down those huge I-beams in the weave room to support the heads, the jacquard heads. They started on one end of the mill on the canal side, going to tear those beams down. I said, geez, I don't understand why. Come to think of it, they were hauling some of that stuff at their mill down south. So they stopped them. From what I could see, they had to stop. All of a sudden, what they had piled up to go out was left on the floor on the main street upstairs, the weave room. But they're the ones that really ruined this place, the beginning of it.
That was in the 1980s?
Well, let's see. That's where I can't... I really didn't know I was going to have an interview to begin with. I thought it was just something like a picture, something they wanted to put in a museum, somebody that's been here for a while, you know, for a little while. Yeah, let's see.
Can you talk to me about what the difference is between the looms, the jacquard looms, and the other looms?
Oh, yeah. Well, what they had over here, in number 1 and 2 weave, was all plain weave. You couldn't weave nothing too fancy, except when they used the daubies in number 5. We had daubies in number 5. They moved them up here in number 1 and 2. Daubies, you know, they have a lot of harnesses. You can put up to 14 harnesses with the daubies, and you can figure out little designs, not big designs, small circles or small squares or triangles or small designs on a daubie. Because they're rigged for plain and plain weave also, but on a jacquard loom you can weave real fancy stuff, you know, a big flower design, or you have special tie-ups to weave like the Queen Elizabeth's and the Martha Washington, the George Washington, and John Adams. Those are the John Adams, the Queen Elizabeth, and some others I can't remember. They were weaved. They were very expensive spreads. Those bedspreads are very. Those were the very expensive spreads. The Queen Elizabeth and the Martha Washington, George Washington, John Adams, all expensive. Like we still have a George Washington as that we've had in around 1950. We had given it to my parents. My parents, after my mother passed away, they gave it to us. They gave it back to us, and we're still using it. They're very good. They're very good bedspreads. If you take care of them, they're very good. Uh, see if I can't go back in between there. A lot of years there.
Yeah. Now, you said your parents worked in the mills?
Yeah, my mother worked in number 5 weave before I was in here.
Right.
She was a battery tender in number 5 weave.
And your father?
And my father worked at the Libby Mill. He was a millwright at the Libby. By the way, I was offered, they don't know here at Bates, they don't know this, but I was offered a job at the Libby as a supervisor. And they wanted to see me. My father's telling me they wanted to see me pretty bad. So I went over to be sociable. But I had to tell them that I am treated very good across the street, and I don't have no plans of changing. But I said, I appreciate your offer, and I'll keep you in mind. I said, you never know what could happen in the future. That's what I told them.
Now, I imagine that your parents spoke French in the home.
Oh, they both. Oh, yeah, we were brought up. I speak French fluently. I have one son, and he lives in Massachusetts, in Gloucester, Massachusetts. And he has a business there with the, it has something to do with the Fishermen's Association. You know, that's a fisherman's town, Gloucester. And I think he has about 6 employees that work for him over there. And he, and by the way, my son worked for me while I was in 1 and 2 weave. He was a changeover man. The people that take out the empty warps off the loom and put a full warp, it's a two-job, it's a two-man operation. While I was here, he started as an oiler in number 1 and 2 weave, my son. And during his summer vacation, I'm talking about, I got him up here. And I was up there for a couple of years. The second time he came, he was a changeover. I paid a little more, so I tried to get him on changeover. It succeeded. It was only for, like, the, you know, vacation time, a couple of months. But he worked here twice. He was happy that I gave him a check.
Now, did your mom and dad still have family in Canada that they went back to visit?
No, I think there is. I have only 2 cousins in Canada that we personally visit. My wife and I. They're both girls. They both lost their husbands, and they live in their parents' house, right there in Saint Honoré, Quebec. And we're planning to go again this summer to pay them a visit. They all had big families. This one only had 2 girls. My mother, it was my mother's sister. She married a Talbot, and they had their 2 daughters. She had a brother. The others all had big families, 14, 15, 16 children, awful big families. She had a brother that lived in St. Hyacinthe. They ran a community store. They sold in that store from diaper pins to meat, shoes, clothes. They had everything in that store. It was a country store. They were running a store like that. That family had 10 children. And right now they're all first cousins, these 10 children. They're all my first cousins. And I wouldn't know where to reach none of them today. It's too bad. 2 of them are running a shirt factory. They started one in St. Honoré. They were employing over 250 girls in that factory, a shirt factory. And then they opened up another one in St. George, and they're still running these 2 factories. They're quite a little bit out of our class, for one thing. You know, they have the money. He was a barber. Besides the store, he had a barber shop in there, you know. One of the sons, we've seen him about 6 years ago for the last time. We had a real nice place. He has a big boat on the lake, and he offered us to go take them. We wouldn't bite on that. I don't want to get involved too much. It's just not our class. There's another one. You want to know about her? My parents' relatives. There's another one that's also in St. Honoré. She married the oldest of the children of that family. They had over 10 children. I never met them all. And the oldest one married into a well-to-do person. He was a contractor. She married a man that was a contractor that built big stuff like bridges and like a skyscraper, big jobs, that kind. So this is another quite high class too. Yeah. We went to see them once there, and they lived in Montreal, and beautiful home. You know.
I grab a rendering out here.
And so I have a question. Were there foods or songs, kind of traditions, that your family brought over to Maine from Canada?
Very little.
Yeah.
Very little. And as far as I can see today, there was nothing brought from Canada. My grandfather, on my father's side, he was born in, let me see now, I've never been to the place. I want to go, but I don't know if I'll ever get there. I'm getting up in age, I don't know. He was born in Tsinwik. My father was born in Tsinwik, Canada. That must be a one-horse town, a small place. And there's one thing that comes from Canada, from my grandfather's side. It's a huge beer.
A beer pitcher?
A pitcher. That's
okay, yeah.
A beer pitcher with a gold trim on top and five glasses that go with it. That comes from my grandfather. So it had to come through Canada. Plus a small cruet. Very fancy cruet. It's only this high. Very fancy cruet. My grandfather died in 1945 while I was in the service. I was able to come to the funeral. I was stationed at the time at Geiger Field in Spokane, Washington. So I had being in the airport, Air Force, I was able to get a priority to come home. But I'm sorry I took the priority. I could have got home as fast on the train because we hopped in four or five different places before, and they dropped. The closest I could get to home was New Jersey. Mm-hmm. I had to take a bus from there to here. I missed the funeral. Mm-hmm. So I was home for a few days and went back.
So were there any meals that your mother made
My mother was a great cook.
What kind of things?
Well, like meat pie, for one thing. That's popular in Canada, right? And I can't mention you what she's cooked, but he was a good cook. Mm-hmm. And the woman I married is a Finn. He's Finnish, right? She speaks Finnish fluently, like I speak French fluently. She writes Finnish, and I can write French. But in between my mother's cooking and my wife's a great cook. My wife has three sisters, and they all great cooks in the family. She still follows her mother's recipe. She makes bread almost every other day or every 3 days. She's making bread. She's made some yesterday for the company we're having today. Homemade bread. Very, very good. And the funny part about it, all these years I was going, was still married. They made it. Her parents made a cake. They called it pico cakey. Okay? So when I first had some pico cakey, I said, you know something? I said, I don't know if your mother got this recipe from Finland or what, but I said, my mother makes the same cake, and she's been making this cake since I was a child growing up. But I said, we never called it a kupi cake, but it's the same thing. Must be the same recipe. I said, tastes the same, exactly the same. Looks the same, tastes the same. Well, funny to talk about.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I have a question. Yeah. You were growing up in Lewiston during the Depression years, 1930s.
Right.
What ways did you experience the Depression?
The Depression, I can't really remember much about the Depression, but I know my father had a hard time during the Depression. Mm-hmm. He was working two jobs. My father was working two jobs during the Depression. And the kids were all small then, so my mother was home. She was a homemaker. She went to work only after we were growing up. She didn't work long in the mill. She just went, I guess, probably to get out of the house. But during the Depression, I can remember my father worked two jobs. I know that. And besides his mill job, he had another job. I can't remember. I think he was helping for a subcontractor for the city. Yeah. It wasn't involved directly with the city. I think it was a subcontractor, and at the time they were putting sewers. If I remember right now, they were putting sewers not far from where we lived on Donald Street. They were putting sewers on Savannah Street at Thorn's Corner. They were digging a lot of digging, and they had to do some black. Around the Holy Family Church. They were digging. They had to dig quite deep. It was a ledge there. They had to do some blasting. And he was working for a company where they were doing blasting and using jackhammers, you know. That was his second job for a while. I know they would have had problems otherwise, but we traded at the time. We bought our groceries at a store at the corner of Randall Road and Sabata Street. There was a store there ran by a Booley. We know the family well. And they took care of us good over there. We could buy, let's say, for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. We wouldn't have to pay. We would just when my father was able to dump some money. So that helped them during the Depression, mm-hmm. you know, helped the family out.
Did you ever get involved in the sports that the mill sponsored?
I never did. No, not at the mill. It's odd because I love hockey. Mm-hmm. At Holy Family, I went to school there. They started a hockey team while I was there. And I played 2 years on the team. But it didn't last. They didn't have a coach at Holy Family. Mm-hmm. That's another funny story. We had a hockey team over there. And the coach was from St. Peter and Paul's. It was a brother from St. Peter and Paul's was coaching the hockey team at Holy Family. So we had a big kick when we came down. We used to play on Bartlett Street. There used to be, they called it the tin can. It was a building, was all corrugated, tin, you know, the walls, coal. It wasn't out of shellac like they have today. We used to come down there. You know where St. Dom's High School used to be on Bartlett Street? Well, it was right next to that, the skating ring. But when we come to play the same level as us from St. Dom's, it was a coach from St. Peter's, and he really, really wanted us to beat them, too, when we used to go. My position was center. I was a fast skater, and I wasn't big. I wasn't on defense. Even though you get checked just the same, but I wasn't on defense. I was center ice faster. So I enjoy it very much. In fact, I have season's ticket for the Maniacs. I've had them since they started, 3 years in a row now. But I won't be getting them next season. They don't know yet, but I'll have to tell them when they call me. They let you know if you want to keep your seat. I'll have to tell them I'll have to drop it because it happens too many times where there's people come up the house and I can't be there. I like the hockey and I got the ticket, so I go to the hockey game. And so I'm gonna. That's one reason, and then my health. I have a bad right hip. I might have to get a hip replacement. I don't know. That's in material. But anyways, I have you got to do a lot of climbing, you know, to get in your seat. I got to have a nice seat to center ice. I wouldn't take a seat otherwise. I had to be in center ice. I got both ends. You know, you see the both ends good. I'm right underneath the press box. Right, center ice.
Are there things that I haven't asked you about the mill that you feel is important to add?
Well, let's see. Well, as far as the mill, like I say, they don't have nothing against Bates. They treated me very well. The only thing I had ever had was that with that one overseer that wouldn't let me get on the... Well, that turned out to be all right. They finally asked me to be a supervisor. And I refused the first time they asked me. I didn't take it. I refused. My wife told me, you can do it. You should have taken it. Try it, you know. So I refused anyways. It took a little while longer. They came back again. So I thought I'd give it a try. And I was on it all the time, till I retired. After I retired, they did call me three times to do some weaving and teaching. I was also running teaching weavers while I was weaving. As a supervisor, they were starting a school over here in the part of out where they used to have the card room was next to the weave room on that end. There was a section that was empty there. They were going to start a school there. And I guess it didn't work out. And I don't know why. I never did get to teach in that area. I was using an office to teach not too far from here, upstairs. I'd have to go upstairs to show you. They gave me a room. I had up to 14 persons one time. But it's a funny thing. One person amongst all of them, one of them was always hitting me with a lot of questions. I could tell that he knew a little bit about the looms. He was from Edwards in Augusta. And so I told him, I said, I've got a guy up there. I said, he's not giving me any problems, but he seems to know quite a bit. I said, I'd like to know some of his background. So they got rid of him, Bates. When they found out who he was, that's when I found out, he was from Edwards, and he was an instigator, and he had been fired from over there, and he was an instigator. So I got rid of that one. Funny, you know, another one, a student, was a girl. It's too bad. She got caught embezzling money at the Holy Family Credit Union. She lost her job. A lot of things happened while I was at base. We have one, I won't mention any name, but we had one that worked for the credit union at Bates. When it was the federal credit union at Bates, I was on a committee for 24 years on a credit union at Bates. There was a guy that was the president at the time, I won't mention his name, he lost his job shoplifting. You know, sometimes it's a disease, you know, it's not that's the way that it's a disease. And then there was another one, maybe you know some of these people, the paymaster of Bates, he was the paymaster. He got caught for sexual harassment with a young girl, not in town here, he lived out of town, and he had to go to jail. At the time, he lost his job at the time. Yeah. You never know. You know, you see these people you work with, and all these things happen. It's shocking, you know.
Were there ever strikes at the mill?
Well, I've never seen any incidents except one with me as a supervisor in number one and two weave. I was on the third. They used to bounce me up around on second shift, third shift. I was on the third shift at the time. A cloth doffer, the people that take the cloth off the loom, the rolls off the loom. We were hiring a cloth. I had to use some other help to work with the cloth doffer. So up until they hired a man, they did. They finally got a man. He was from Bates College. I didn't know that, but he was from Bates College to come in on a third shift. So I'm sitting in the office over there, and 10:45, nobody. 10 of 11, nobody. We started at 11, you know. 11 o'clock, nobody. He never showed up because the office had told me there was supposed to be a so-and-so come in. Never showed up. So I went into my routine, checked the two rooms, one and two weaves, make sure everybody is in and everything, everybody's on their job, whatever, it takes 15 minutes, half an hour. When I'm done doing that, that's the first thing I do in the mornings, and I go back in the office to do some paperwork and whatever. When I came back, see, there wasn't too many people on the third shift. So when I came back, this guy is in the office sitting on my desk, you know. He took off his boots, had them on the floor, and was sitting on my desk. So I went in, he was sitting on, it's a double desk, you know, the overseer sat on that side, I had my over here, it's a big desk. You were sitting on the corner, the door's right there. You're sitting on that corner of the desk. My chair's over here. And I had a big computer right here, you know? So the old type, key type. And I was sitting there. I have a telephone next to me there. He was sitting on my... So I came, I sat down. I looked at my paper. I said, "You must be so-and-so." And he said, "Yeah." I got up. I introduced myself. He was under the... He was intoxicated. Yeah. I could smell it on him, too. So I told him, I said, "You know," I said, "I can't put you to work today. But I'm going to give you a break." I said, "You come back tomorrow night, sober, fit to work, and I'll give you a job." I said, "I can't put you on a job tonight. You can't go to work." I said, it's dangerous for you and for the people you're working with. So I cannot put you to... He got mad. He got up, and he gave me a shove. My telephone landed on the floor. The computer almost went on the floor. It was heavy too, but it didn't, you know, get off, but it didn't fall. My chair tipped over, and there was a radiator on this wall here. And I landed, and I hit my head on the radiator, but I didn't really hurt, but I was lucky. But I was hoping I would see someone through the window, you know, there's windows in that office, to call, you know, so I won't be alone with him. Because I finally got up. But he didn't hassle me anymore after I got up. But I did finally got in touch with the shop steward. Happened to go by, and I motioned to him to come in. Well, I stepped in the door, and I told him, I said, "I'm having a problem. I want you to call a guard right now." So he did. They came over, and they took him out. He didn't want to leave. He said, "You weren't going to go to work, period." I said, "I can't put you..." So anyway, they got him out. The next day, I head for the personnel office. I told them about the incident. And I told them that I didn't want to see the guy again, period. The way he acted towards me, I said, "I don't want him up there." They never bothered with... They didn't rehire him or anything. They got rid of him. That's the only thing I ever had as a supervisor. I was a little worried that nobody's going to show up, you know, who knows what's going to happen. And I was told by the, it was Steve Crowley at the time, I think he was. Steve Crowley is the one that asked me to be a supervisor. Do you know Steve Crowley? You don't know Steve Crowley?
I know the name.
You know the name, yeah. Well, he's the one that asked me and another guy on the job. We both went in as supervisors together. The other person was Stanley Judd. He was the other person. We both got on at the same time. So Crowley told me personally that he was very glad that I never touched that person. I could have poked him in between the eyes so easy, you know, but I never touched him. I was able to handle the thing without touching him, you know.
Is there anything else that we should add, or do you feel like you've given me what you know?
There might be things. Well, you know, we've had nice times at Bates. They had a big time at the Armory when they had the, and this is a Frenchman came to...
Maurice
Chevalier. Oh, it was beautiful. They had a beautiful evening for us over there.
And Bates paid for that?
Oh, yeah, Bates paid for that. Right, right, right.
And did you ever go to the picnics? They had picnics in the summer.
Oh yeah. We used to have picnics at Montagnard on the Pond Road, No Name Pond. And we used to have a lot of good times earlier. It cost money. We used to go in Poland there at summer resort in Poland.
Oh, Poland Spring House.
Yeah, Poland Spring House. They used to have nice times over there. Yeah.
Yeah. And was that in like the 50s? And
it's hard for me to give you a date. I hate to give you a date, and it wouldn't be right, you know.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, in the later years, did things stop? Did the events stop happening?
They finally stopped, I guess, because of the money, maybe, you know. But it must have cost money to have those banquets. They've had hundreds of people go there, and they gave watches for the ones that were retiring at 50 years, and then when they were giving 10-year pins and 25-year pins, you know. So I've got a 10-year pin, 25-year pin, but I never got a watch. They wouldn't keep me long enough to get a watch.
Were you there, what, 48 years?
48 years, yeah. Long time, a lifetime, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.